You're listening to The Way Home with Daniel Darling, a proud member of the Denham Audio Network.
Hello and welcome to the Way Home Podcast. This is your host, Daniel Darling. I'm so glad that you've joined me today. We have a great conversation lined up for you, and I'm excited about the guest that is going to come on here in a minute, talking about Christianity and the public square and public policy and all kinds of important topics. But before we talk about that, I want to let you know first about my newsletter. It's called One Little Word, and you can subscribe to it on my website, danieldarling.com. There's a paid version and a free version, and would love for you to get that, to find out kind of what I'm doing, some of the articles I'm writing, keep up with life and ministry here. But also there's some exclusive free content that I'll write, particularly helpful stuff on things like leadership and Christianity in the public square, and writing, and parenting, and all sorts of stuff. So if that's something that you like, you can go to danieldarling.com and sign up for it as well. Also, wanted to let you know, my book, Agents of Grace, is still out there and available. It talks about how to think about unity in the church. What are some issues we should prioritize? What are some issues that we should hold loosely? This is especially difficult in a very divisive political season. And this may be a book that you might be interested in for you, for your small group, for your church. It's called Agents of Grace. It's available from Zondervan, everywhere books are sold, but you can go to my website, danieldarling.com, and find links to it. Okay, let's get on with our conversation, this time with my friend Mark Tooley. Mark is a really prominent intellectual and thinker in Washington, D.C. He's president of the Institute on Religion and Democracy, and he's editor of the Foreign Policy and National Security Journal, Providence, a journal of Christianity and American foreign policy. He worked for 8 years for the Central Intelligence Agency and is a graduate of Georgetown University. Mark has written extensively essays and books and all sorts of things, is a really thoughtful voice on the intersection of Christianity and public policy, Christianity and democracy. He's also a prominent Methodist, as I tell him, and I joke often with him as a Baptist. Mark is my favorite Methodist. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. Let's join Mark Tooley. Well, I'm glad to have my friend Mark Tooley back on the podcast. Mark, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it.
A great pleasure to be with you, Dan.
So, Mark, I want to start, in case our audience has not read your work or is not familiar with the Institute for Religion and Democracy or with Providence Journal Magazine, which is so well done. Can you explain a little bit about the Institute for Religion and Democracy and how you came to sort of be involved with this?
The IRD was founded in 1981, obviously during the Cold War, when many church groups, especially mainline Protestants, but also others, were actively supporting Marxist regimes and revolutionary movements as the best Christian way to express solidarity with the poor, especially in Latin America. IRD's founders thought this was very destructive and countered that Christians involved in politics should not support dictatorship and authoritarianism, but instead should support democracy, human rights, and religious freedom for all people. And that remains our theme across 40 years.
Yeah, that's great. And so I think for folks who are not as familiar with, I think a lot of evangelical Christians are not as familiar or really don't feel like they have the handles how to think through some of these things, particularly when it comes to, you know, foreign policy, what to think about things overseas. I think IRD and Providence Journal have really provided a wonderful resource for that. And I want to encourage folks to check out Providence Journal website and magazine. But Mark, when you think about this, you often talk about a realist foreign policy, a democratic realism. Explain what that means, you know, how the Christian faith informs kind of how we should approach these things.
Well, you mentioned our foreign policy journal, Providence, which we founded in 2016 to be a voice of Christian realism, we often cite the mid-20th century theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who's most associated with Christian realism. What is Christian realism? Well, it's dealing with humanity as it is, not as we wish it to be, understanding humanity is fallen and self-interested and often prone to very dark influences. But strict realism, divorced from Christianity, is often very cynical and assumes people cannot rise above a very narrow self-interest and looks at the world as just a ongoing conflict among various tribes and interests. Christian realism is not that. Christian realism understands God is sovereign, he is redeeming the world, he's providentially involved in the affairs of humanity. So, yes, we are fallen, but there is always hope because of divine sovereignty.
Yeah, and, you know, I think when we think about foreign policy, it seems like there's a couple different ways that we can maybe think wrongly. One is a way of a sort of like we have to, you know, that Americans, you know, can do everything, that we can make every country into democracy, or we can change the world. You know, we have limits as a country. I think another way is to go the other way and to sort of withdraw from the world and do nothing. Right? That's the world's problem. That's not our problem. You know, so as you're thinking through this, as you're helping Christians think through what the right approach is, it seems like Christian realism is kind of that middle way to say, you know, we obviously want to be realistic about what's going on in the world, but there are ways that America as a superpower can be involved. We can work for peace and all those kinds of things. So share a little bit of how you counsel and how you advise and speak about this for Christians.
Firstly, we have to be careful to make clear not to profess that there is a specifically Christian foreign policy that all Christians must adhere to. The Lord has not revealed to us his detailed preferences for American foreign policy or national security details. So we approach these issues with a Christian sensibility, but what we're addressing are primarily topics of prudential judgment, and we can agree to disagree on many of these topics. But from a Christian realist perspective, and especially starting with Reinhold Niebuhr, who in the 1920s and 1930s had become a Christian pacifist in reaction against World War I, which he had supported, and much of American Christianity was not just pacifist or pacifist adjacent, but also very isolationist in the 1930s, and I think contributed unintentionally to America's passivity towards the rise of the Axis powers, and in that sense contributed to the horror and avoidable calamity of World War II. Niebuhr arose out of his pacifism in the late 1930s and started a journal in 1941 to advocate for American Christians, to advocate for America's full engagement in the world, especially to help the democratic powers against the Axis powers. And that understanding should still inform us today that America is a obviously sinful and fallen nation, but nonetheless, mostly a force for good in the world, a force for stability, a culture and society that believes in some sense, however faulty, in the dignity and human rights of all people, that we prefer a world in which America is more dominant as opposed to a world where Russia or China or other malevolent powers are dominant. And so we should, in our foreign policy, not just as a matter of national interest and protection of the American people, but also a more enlightened self-interest, to support forces that are for democracy, human rights, especially religious freedom, and that protects sovereignty for all nations, especially those nations that are vulnerable to larger predatory powers. Obviously, Ukraine right now falls into that category, and support for democratic countries like Israel contending with adversaries that would like their annihilation.
I want to talk about a couple of specific places around the globe. You mentioned there's debate right now about, you know, how much involvement we should have with Ukraine as they're trying to fight to, you know, as Russia's invaded their country and they're trying to fight for their country. There's a bit of war weariness in the country because of Iraq and Afghanistan that I think it spilled over and created a kind of a neo-isolationism, if you will, even places you were, you wouldn't expect it. But you've made the case, and I've made the case, that we should continue to help Ukraine to defeat Russia, if only to thwart their advance throughout Europe. But why should the U.S. specifically help Ukraine? Why should we give them weapons? Why should we come alongside them?
Obviously, there's the straightforward moral case. This was a nation that was, for no reason, attacked by a much larger neighbor that would like to eradicate them as a nation and impose upon them a form of dictatorship that would eradicate their national identity. And the cruelties that we've already seen in terms of the kidnapping of Ukrainian children would only accelerate if Russia were to prevail in that struggle. But speaking from the national interests of the United States, Putin and the government of Russia have made clear that they are adversaries of the United States, of the West, of the democracies, and they see us as strategic adversaries. And so it's in our interest to limit the ambitions and predatory nature of Putin's regime, and it's relatively inexpensive to help Ukraine survive and hopefully ultimately defeat the Russian invasion of their country. Relatively inexpensive for the United States and for other Western allies to help them help themselves, as opposed to standing by and allowing Ukraine to be defeated and absorbed and encouraging Russian aggression, such that perhaps next Russia will more directly target a NATO nation in a way that would directly pull us into a conflict war with Russia itself, which we very much would like to avoid. In terms of Christian realism, Reinhold Niebuhr, when he began speaking out on these issues in 1940, 1941, his slogan was all support for the Allies short of war, and I think that should be our slogan with Ukraine. We do not want to fight Russia directly, if at all avoidable, but to help others defend themselves seems like a clear-cut case that serves our interest and also is morally right. Mm.
I want to pivot a little bit to Israel. We've seen the last few months, Israel is, there's an ongoing war in Gaza, Israel against Hamas in response to the October 7th attacks by Hamas on Israeli civilians. In the United States, you know, there's a surprising level of debate even about this, even right after October 7th. You'd think that people would sympathize with Israel. And I think overwhelmingly there was support, but there's still some folks who are kind of in between, even a lot of Christians saying, I don't know, Israel, Gaza, should I take a side? Why is it imperative for American Christians to support, at least support Israel's right to exist and defend themselves? And why should the United States as a country support that?
Many reasons. Obviously, we're especially sensitive to the historic plight of the Jewish people, among the most persecuted people in human history. And Israel emerged in the wake of the Holocaust, in which a particular regime tried to eradicate all the Jews of Europe and very nearly succeeded. So we would like to support the Jewish people in their right to exist without fear of annihilation. Israel is a democracy. It's pro-Western. It's pro-American. It's been a fairly reliable ally for America across 75 years. It continues to be surrounded by forces that are unwilling to accept it as a sovereign nation. Among those forces is, of course, Hamas, which functions often primarily as a proxy of Iran. And Israel, as a very geographically small nation with only 9 million people, doesn't have a lot of room for error. We, as Americans, surrounded by two oceans with our 340 million, often assume that others can live as comfortably as we can. Israel does not have that luxury. And so Hamas is not as strong as Israel, but as we saw on October 7th, it has the power to kill hundreds, if not thousands, of Israelis with arms provided by Iran. And so Israel rightly wishes to remove Hamas as a threat. I think all decent people can support Israel's eradication of Hamas. All wars are horrible. We grieve all wars. Innocent people are killed in all wars. We hope to minimize those losses, but the horrors of this war in Gaza are precipitated by Hamas, and it's a safe assumption there can be no permanent peace until Hamas is removed as a major factor. Mm.
Let's talk a little bit about just war. I mean, that could be a conversation for hours, but you know, a lot of things we talked about when we, in the aftermath of October 7th, was just war, that Israel has the right to defend themselves, the right to defend their people. Share a little bit about why you believe in just war and why it's a good framework for us thinking through some of these conflicts.
Christianity's historic just war teaching has been a major theme for our journal, Providence, and we have one of America's leading just war scholars, Mark Levecki, as an editor of Providence. Just war teaching comes and go in terms of its popularity in American Christianity. It had been kind of forgotten by the mid or late 20th century, but Paul Ramsey at Princeton University helped to resurrect it, at least for Protestants, in the 1960s and 1970s, and then sometimes it's forgotten again. And then when we have a military conflict, it reemerges, and Christians are searching for the moral and ethical tools to address issues of war and peace. We founded Providence in large part because we were distressed by the predominance of at least a soft form of pacifism among a lot of Christian, Protestant, and evangelical elites, many of whom had been influenced by Stanley Hauerwas, who was himself mentored by John Howard Yoder, two very influential intellectuals who had reinterpreted Christian pacifism to be not a teaching that says particular individuals or communities are called to nonviolence, but instead insisting nonviolence was the chief characteristic of Christianity itself, and all faithful Christians must renounce all violence, even by governments, which historically Christianity has understood were ordained by God to utilize violence in cases of law enforcement and necessary military actions. In a sense, we've somewhat declared victory in that I think pacifism is much less influential in American Christianity now than it was 7 or 8 years ago. And October 7th and Russia's attack on Ukraine, I think, have contributed to that sense of reality that we don't have the luxury to step aside and behave as neutral bystanders and to preach to others that they must be nonviolent and not defend themselves from predatory aggressors. So the just war teaching is extremely important, and the fact that our government, all just governments are ordained to use violence in some circumstances, without which there could be no order, no peace, and no tranquility, no protection for those who are most vulnerable.
Yeah, that's really good. I teach about this when I teach ethics at Texas Baptist College here, and you know, I try to make the case that all of us who live in peace, we live in peaceful communities, we live under the umbrella of someone who obviously wasn't a pacifist, right? Because somebody sacrificed and was willing to enter into conflict to secure that peace, right? And so not to say there isn't a respectful tradition of pacifism in Christianity, it does tend to rely on people who aren't pacifists, you know? And I think that's an important way of thinking of it, that God does give, you know, Romans 13, God gives the sword to the governments to avenge evil. One of the other topics you talk a lot about is kind of the relationship between the church and the state, the interplay between Christianity and governments. There's a lot of conversation about this right now with, you know, sort of the buzzword Christian nationalism, which, you know, we would both agree that often that's a pejorative that's applied to anybody who wants to apply their faith to the public square. But there are some folks who, particularly in academic circles, both whether it's on the Catholic side, Catholic integralists, or maybe on the Protestant side, folks who are genuine Christian nationalists, who are saying that perhaps this idea of liberal democracy, this idea that a free church and a free state, this project hasn't worked. It's ushered in all this other stuff. Maybe we need to start over with a sort of a Christian state. And you've argued against that and hosted a lot of events kind of talking through this. But why do you think this is resurgent, number one? And number two, why do you still feel like this idea of liberal democracy is a project worth preserving?
I've been at the IRD now 30 years, and much of our work has entailed critiquing and rebutting the religious left, much of whom have claimed that religious conservatives actually have the hidden agenda of imposing a Christian theocracy on America. When President George W. Bush was reelected in 2004, there were wide warnings and complaints because of evangelical support for his reelection that this was just the first step towards a new Christian theocracy. All of that, of course, was absurd, and there were always very, very few conservative Christians in America who wanted anything like a Christian democracy. And the vast majority of conservative Christians in America have always supported what the Declaration of Independence declares, what the Constitution declares in terms of religious freedom, freedom of speech, legal equality for all citizens of our nation. So it's been very surprising and distressing in recent years. There have been a small number, but still influential and formidable Christian thinkers and writers who are now rejecting this quote-unquote legacy of liberalism and denying that we should offer religious freedom to all people, and instead asking that Christianity and Christians be given special legal privileges. I first noticed 5 or 6 years ago here in Washington, D.C., a growing number of very intelligent, educated Catholic young men who were quote-unquote integralist, which was a system of thought advocating that we return to essentially the Middle Ages, where the Catholic Church was paramount in society, including in civil law. And encountering them, I thought, oh, inevitably there's going to be a Protestant counterpart. And now there are a number of intelligent, educated young men who declare that, again, liberalism, religious freedom have failed, and that true Protestant teaching requires that we have a Protestant confessional state that legally privileges Protestant Christianity and Protestant Christians, and that would punish blasphemy and heresy. The vast majority of Americans, and including of Christians, would be scandalized by that suggestion, but I'm concerned that this argument in our current so-called post-liberal moment seems to have some traction. And if the church and if Christians are to have an effective and faithful social and political witness in America, I think heading down this path of demanding special privileges for ourselves is a very destructive path and will not lead to anything productive or constructive for Christianity in America.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we think about, what do you think about, you know, obviously as a Baptist, and you believe this as a Methodist as well, that, you know, we like to think that a Christian, an explicitly Christian state, where the state is actually making theological decisions, where it's punishing heresy, it's punishing wrong belief, and rewarding right belief in terms of religious belief. We like to think, well, if we just had the right people in charge, it would actually work. But if you look through, you know, if you look through history, that's always been a bad combination, right? You really can't trust governments in a fallen world to make explicitly theological distinctions, right? And I think the founders understood this, right? They understood that that kind of power is really dangerous. They'd seen what had happened throughout church history, and so does it seem like at times we're so used to liberal democracy, so used to freedom, that we almost take it for granted. We almost don't appreciate the liberties we have, to where we think, man, everything's bad. We need to, you know, scrap this whole system and start over.
Yes. So many of these esoteric conversations and complaints emerge from our decadence, in the sense that we're so wealthy and we're so free and we have so much security. We have the time and energy and the boredom that leads us down these unfortunate pathways. If we were more threatened and had less wealth, we would be less tempted. We not even have the ability to indulge these, I call them utopian fantasies of a Christian state. And of course, as Christians, we should know with our insights into human nature that even if the so-called right people are in charge, even the right people are easily corrupted and distracted and become self-serving. And so it's in the interest of every society not to give too much power, even to the right people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. Lastly, I want to ask you, you're probably my favorite and definitely the most famous Methodist that I know. You have been really involved with some of the conversations in the United Methodist Church. Now, obviously, there's been this split with people who hold the Orthodox Christian teaching, forming the Global United Methodists, splitting away from the mainline, really the last of the mainlines to split, right? So talk about your view of where that is now, and what do you see as the future? Does this Global United Methodism seems like it has a chance to really flourish now that they're anchored to Orthodox beliefs? What do you see the future for that?
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be your favorite Methodist. I'm curious how many Methodists you know, but I'm glad you at least know one. I've spent my whole adult life working on trying to reform the United Methodist Church, in which I was raised and to which I came to faith in Christ. And so this end result of a schism was not my hope, but I think it's the best possible outcome in that conservative congregations had a window of opportunity to leave with their property. The property was owned by the denomination, so that not typically was possible. But so far, 7,670 some churches have left the United Methodist Church. Maybe 2/3, 80% are joining the new Global Methodist Church. It would appear that about 1.5 million United Methodists, at least on paper, left the U.S. part of the denomination, which had 6 million members several years ago. So it's numerically, it's probably the biggest schism in American religious history. And after Methodism has been essentially dying for the last 60 or 70 years, being suffocated by theological liberalism, now there is an opportunity for traditional Methodism to be replanted around the country where it has died in the major cities on the East Coast, the West Coast, in college towns. So I'm hopeful this new community of 7,000, 8,000 congregations can perform this task of replanting Methodism. The challenges are many. One of them is that denominationalism and loyalty to denominations, of course, is fast dying in America, and American Protestantism and evangelicalism has become post-denominational. And so Methodism will have to contend with that. But it should be pointed out, the Global Methodist Church is not an old-style denomination of a centralized command and control bureaucracy. That model is over. It's more of a network of churches that own their own property and have authority over the appointment of their own pastors. And so I think this is the future of effective American Protestantism, not so much centralized denominations, but networks of collaboration. Mm.
Yeah, that's good. And, you know, as a Baptist, I'm rooting for the Methodists to flourish. I feel like evangelicalism could use a revived Methodism, you know, to, I think it'd be good for really the church and good for the country. So praying that is something that happens, you know.
Well, thank you. And obviously it was Methodists and Baptists who were the chief partners in
the
Second Great Awakening that transformed America. So hopefully we can, with God's favor, do the same in the next few decades.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Mark Tooley, thank you. I want to encourage folks to check out the Institute for Religion and Democracy. They have really great resources. And then also Providence Journal Magazine is really a phenomenal resource when it comes to understanding the world, how to think about global conflicts from a Christian perspective, how to think about liberal democracy and government and Christianity. Highly recommend it. Mark, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Dan. Always a pleasure, and appreciate your good work.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Way Home Podcast with Daniel Darling. For more information, you can visit danieldarling.com. If you do like this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast catcher. We also encourage you to rate and review so others can know about the podcast. You can follow me at Dan Darling on Twitter or go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/Daniel M. Darling. Thank you for listening to the Way Home Podcast.